Hi, this is Tess Vigeland with your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of July 29th, 2011. For months now, though it feels like an eternity, August 2nd has loomed as large as the end of days, or so it seems.
We don't know exactly how it's going to impact us, so we go to the default option, which is, panic. But fundamentally, the issue is, what does default mean? And obviously, to many people, it has been exploded out as this idea of you're going to lose your money.
All right, stop flapping your arms, everyone. We've got some AAA-rated advice to safeguard your peace of mind. Plus, ending a marriage is never easy, especially when you're married in a mortgage.
Well, on paper, I'm divorced. I mean, am I really? No, absolutely not. I mean, we still have a house together.
And some of the best presents don't come in boxes.
This limerick is written for Tess regarding the debt ceiling mess.
Yes, ceilings, limericks, and divorce. You can't miss Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
All right. People, can we please just calm down?
The U.S. Treasury can no longer legally borrow any money, and it says that could sink the economic recovery.
Congress either raises the debt ceiling by early August, or we could all pay a devastating price.
If you think this economy is bad now, wait till the word gets around the world that Uncle Sam has become a deadbeat.
Enough already. Stop the madness. You are scaring my listeners. And you know what else? This all sounds way, way too familiar to me. I remember the last time sure financial Armageddon was just around the corner, and it wasn't that long ago, less than 3 years. We got exactly the same questions from you. What can we do? Well, my guess is that this time around, we have some of the same answers. And for those, we have brought back Jason Zweig of the Wall Street Journal and psychiatrist and investment advisor Dr. Richard Peterson of the firm Market Psych. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Good to be
here. Great to be with you.
Last time the three of us got together to talk about what was going on in the financial system was 2.5 years ago, March of 2009. We all remember what was happening then?
Absolutely.
Oh, yes.
The Dow hitting 6,500. And everybody panicking and wanting to know if they should just get out of the markets altogether. And I have to tell you, we're starting to see that again in our listener mail. Carrie Hunt in Chicago wrote in, said, I haven't heard or found a single story on how regular people like me can or should be preparing for financial apocalypse. Greg wrote in from Durham, North Carolina. Sorry, Marketplace. This time it's too weird to follow the standard advice of invest for the long term. I have no idea what to expect, but my 401k and I are going to be on the sideline until this shakes out. Richard?
There is a lot of fear because I think there's a lot of uncertainty. A lot of people haven't seen what it means. And all they hear is we have D-Day, August 2nd. If we don't have a solution by then, it's over.
Right.
And the question is, how do you position yourself as an investor? Our knee-jerk reaction, it's something called the familiarity bias. We go towards what we know and what we're comfortable with, which is cash in the bank.
Jason?
There are people who talk a lot about going off the grid.
Yeah, buying seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, I have friends who have talked about that.
Yeah, but my general philosophy as an investor is I don't want a lot of things sitting around my property that somebody will murder me for if worst comes to worst. So I'm not a big believer in burying gold in my backyard or filling my basement full of tuna fish, because if the end of the world really does come and the financial system completely falls apart,
we're going to be at your house.
The looters are going to come after me, not you, if I have all that stuff. But you need to protect yourself against the risk that the U.S. will no longer dominate the global economy the way it has for our entire lifetimes. And it's also possible the dollar will recover in the future. We don't know that either.
Very true.
But Richard, yes, of course, we're taking it to the extreme. But, you know, the cans of tuna, the gold, all that stuff.
Container in the mountains.
Is it just patently absurd that we're even going there because of talk about the debt ceiling?
But this is how we catastrophize.
Yes, we are catastrophizing.
We don't know exactly how it's going to impact us. So we go to the default option, which is panic. But fundamentally, the issue is, what does default mean? And obviously, to many people, it has been exploded out as this idea of you're going to lose your money. At the same time, there's no way to prepare if you have sizable savings that need a very liquid place to put them.
Okay. Well, Richard, I'm going to ask you as a psychiatrist to put me on the couch.
There's no pillow.
I am the American consumer. I am the American investor. I'm freaking out. What are you going to tell me?
There's a reason to be scared, because things are changing. The difference between most investor fear is that right now investors feel like they have no control over what's happening. So what you've got to do is find something you can control, whether it's finding an investment advisor who will work with you and educate you about how to diversify your money right now, how to protect yourself from a default. Do something that you can control. Or if the information bothers you, turn off the TV if you're a long-term investor.
Yeah.
Don't get caught up in the short term.
Don't turn off the radio, though.
don't turn off this show, but everything right. else. Yeah. But it's really about finding where you are afraid and what you are feeling out of control about. And all this information is confusing, and it makes us feel uncertain, like there's nothing we can do. But you can take some steps with your own money. And I don't mean pull it all out of the market, but changing how you take in information.
Well, then, Jason, let me follow that up by asking you whether people should even be taking action at a point like this. Again, to compare it to March of 2009, our advice back then, the three of us sitting around the table, was, look, people, you're investing for the long term. Keep it steady. Maybe make a few small moves, but don't do anything rash. Does that hold this time, or should people actually be taking some sort of action?
One thing you can do, I think, is you can take a deep breath and ask yourself if you can think of an example back to the history that you've lived through or that you've heard about where people saw a disaster coming that actually came. This, you know, I did a column recently and I called this the neon swan,
right,
as opposed to the black swan from the book by Nassim Taleb. And the black swan is something that's unpredictable, unexpected, hugely important, and understandable only in hindsight. And here we have a neon swan. It's perfectly predictable. We all see it coming. There's nothing surprising about it if it does happen. It's completely out of everyone's control, and it's staring us all in the face. And the markets are stubbornly refusing to react to it, which tells you one of two things. Either the hundreds of millions of professional investors who move money around all day long are staring this thing in the face and don't understand it any better than we do, or the markets have already decided that there just isn't very much you can do about it, and it probably isn't going to happen, at least not the way people expect it to. So my advice would be, if you do anything, do something gradually and do it in moderation rather than taking some large, sudden step like moving all your money into cash. Because after all, if treasuries default and you have all your money in cash,
that's not very
helpful,
is it? Cash
is probably in the form of treasuries,
right.
So that might not be the best idea either. And people shouldn't be blasé about it, and they shouldn't say, oh, this could never happen or this won't happen. It probably won't, and it probably won't happen in the most obvious form. But I think we all need to come to terms with the fact that the credit of the United States is not what it once was, and it's more important than ever for people to be globally diversified.
All right. Dr. Richard Peterson, Jason Zweig, thank you both so much for coming in.
Thanks, Tess.
Thanks, Tess.
And while we're making comparisons, two surveys measuring consumer confidence this week said sentiment is back down to where it was in March of 2009. All right, well, if that wasn't quite enough debt ceiling talk for you, we've got a guest economist writing about it on our Making Money blog. All right, let's get on with something a little more pleasant, shall we? Like vacation. I've got one coming up in a couple of weeks, leaving on a jet plane. But millions of folks are hitting the road for their summer trips this year. And if you're still working up a budget for a road trip, do not forget to factor in tolls. Across the country, new toll roads are opening and existing ones are making you pay a whole lot more for the privilege. David Schultz of station WAMU explains why.
Kyle Ahmadi and his family are traveling from their home in Northern Virginia up to New York City and Niagara Falls. Right now, they're standing near the vending machines at a rest stop in Maryland. Kyle says the cost of tolls will add up for his family's vacation caravan.
Yeah, I'm actually concerned because we're two cars. We have two cars. So each one, probably it's going to be like $70, $80 just because of the toll.
To the west of Washington, residents in suburban McLean, Virginia are also worried about tolls, but for a different reason. One of the major east-west arteries here is the Dulles Toll Road. Its tolls have crept up slowly over the past few years, and they're at $2 now, but dramatic increases are expected in the near future. Rob Jackson with the McLean Neighborhood Association is worried that at some point, driving on the highway will become unaffordable.
Once you hit five, six, seven, they're talking as high as $11 in the future per one-way trip. Unless we have incredible inflation, you're going to see more and more people saying, I'm just not going to pay that.
And that means more commuters will avoid the toll road and opt instead for the local roads that cut right through Jackson's community.
These are two-lane roads, and I don't think they'd be easily widened. The right-of-way costs would be immense, and I don't think the neighbors would want a four-, six-lane road going through their neighborhood.
These kinds of issues are cropping up all across the country. Ron Kirby is a local transportation planner in the D.C. region. He says states and cities are looking to toll roads as a solution to their transportation funding problems.
There isn't enough revenue to add new facilities. There's barely enough to maintain and operate what we have. So this is the place people are turning to.
The only problem is any new toll roads have to win approval from local political leaders. Kirby has been studying the political feasibility of tolls in the D.C. region, and he says, surprisingly, many people are actually fine with building new toll roads, but...
When you start changing tolls on roads they're depending on, raising them, or proposing to put tolls on roads that are not yet tolled, that's a very different matter.
For example, there are plans to raise tolls by almost $2 on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, which is just about the only way to get to and from Maryland's Eastern Shore. That doesn't sit too well with Mike McDermott, a state legislator from the Eastern Shore, speaking at a recent public hearing on the toll hikes.
The day has come for you to get off our back.
The political response to a series of new toll roads in the D.C. region has been, shall we say, a little more subdued. One new toll highway opened earlier this year in Maryland, another is under construction in Virginia, and a third is in the planning stages. Something to keep in mind as you head out on a road trip this summer. In Washington, I'm David Schultz for Marketplace Money.
David's piece came to us from the Transportation Nation Reporting Project. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and I am now joined in the studio by Patty Hirsch, who is doing such a fine job as fill-in show producer that he's agreed to go through our mailbag. Hey, Patty.
Hello, Tess. Thank you. You know, I want to tell you about last week's show and the haul of mail that we've got.
Haul?
Oh, yeah, here it is.
Holy cow.
See, and one of the most popular stories that we got mail about was on Social Security and how people from different generations view it. And
right.
Here's one letter from Charlotte Freeman. She wrote in from Livingston, Montana. She said she's helping to support her aging mother, and nothing is better at making people save more than to see someone who only has Social Security to live on. But William Knox from Madison, Wisconsin, had a comment about the assumption that Social Security is a safety net that only seniors can use. He wrote, and I quote, 40% of Social Security benefits go to the non-elderly. 40% of Social Security benefits go to the non-elderly. And he went on for some time like this. And of course, he's absolutely right. And as we said in the story, Social Security does need to change by 2036 if it's not to go bust. And that may indeed mean reducing the benefits that go to the non-elderly. So it's nice to receive such enthusiastic support from a listener.
Yeah, even if he did not mean it that way,
yeah,
Patty.
Even then, yeah. Okay, so moving on to your chat with reporter Adrian Hill about selling parts of yourself.
Yeah, this was your disgusting idea, as I recall.
Yeah, I'm happy to own it. You know, I'm happy to say also that it met with some very positive comments, including this one from Justin Miller, who offered up, for example, his own experience with personal finance.
I've spent a whole year selling my body parts through plasma and medical tests. Surprisingly, I made approximately $6,000 to $7,000 a year or about 2 hours of effort a week. Not a horrible way to supplement an income.
Indeed. I guess he must have needed the money pretty badly, though. What did he spend it on?
Are you ready for this? His son's college education.
Wow.
Yeah, I was pretty impressed. It made me wish I'd kind of heard his story before we spoke to Susie Orman.
Well, she might have shouted at him for taking a risk with his health.
Yeah, she might. She might. Maybe not as loud as she shouted at one of her viewers, as we heard last week.
Right. Now, this is the lady who wanted to retire at 60. She had almost $800,000 in savings, but...
Yeah, but Susie said it wasn't enough. She said she'd have to live on $1,800 a month, and that would be tough to do. And that triggered a tsunami of mail.
A tsunami?
Well, maybe just a deluge.
Yeah, right.
Christine Harkness wrote in from Pittsburgh to say she nearly drove off the road when she heard that. She's a university professor and says she lives on $1,800 a month. And she suggested that Susie ought to get out more. And Jean Davis from Denver, Colorado, had this to say.
Well, I thought that Susie seemed to be basing her viewpoint in terms of someone in the upper middle class or upper class. Many people live on $20,000 a year. That woman that she was talking about would also qualify for Social Security, which would soon enough give her more than $20,000 per year. I don't think that Susie's attitude is helpful because it puts people off, like the 80% or so that don't even make $50,000 a year.
All right. I suppose it's a fair point. We should say that we did try to contact Ms. Orman to get her response to this, and we have not heard back.
I think she's pretty busy.
A little bit.
But finally, now I don't know about you, but I really enjoyed the dance-off that you and David Lazarus had last week. And I'm not alone. So did Gina Smith from Maryville, Missouri.
After the morning news about the debt ceiling debate and the Norwegian tragedies, the breakdance portion was so funny that it lifted my mood considerably. Thanks.
You're welcome. And thank you for writing in. And thank you, Patty, for all your help.
You're welcome.
And please do keep your comments coming. You can post on our Facebook page. You can tweet me at Radio Tess or write to us at marketplace.org. Patty, it's been fun to have you here.
It's been wonderful. Thank you.
And I believe we have someone else coming in the door.
Who's that? Oh, Kathy Kristoff. Hi.
Hey, Patty. How's it going?
Oh, this means I have to leave now?
Yes, you got it. You're booted.
Okay.
Good to see you.
Likewise.
Thanks for coming in. So we will point out for those who have been on the moon that you write for Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine.
That'd be me. Yes.
So we were just talking about this Susie Orman segment that we had on the show last week, where she was talking about how she felt that $800,000 just was not enough money for a 60-year-old person to retire. But I want to ask you, if you're getting close to retirement, how are you supposed to know when enough is enough?
Well, you know, the thing is you can't answer how much is enough until you know how much you spend. And so it really was an inadequate answer by Susie. She didn't ask this woman, well, what do you live on right now? Because that's really what it all pivots on. If you are a person who lives very frugally, you've paid off your house, you are basically just need to buy groceries and a few other things, you can live very comfortably on $20,000 a year. If you're a person who still has a mortgage, you live in an expensive area, you want a nice car, then all of a sudden what Susie's saying is absolutely accurate. But there's no way to know without asking those questions.
Right. Well, and that's where you get to, you know, we often hear this rule of, 70 or 80% of your working life income is what you're going to want to have. Is that still a rule of thumb? Is that still accurate?
Well, you know, again, it's only accurate if you still have a mortgage and you still have many of the expenses that you had when you were working. Just by being retired, certain expenses will drop, like your income taxes, for instance, because you won't have as much income. But if you don't have a mortgage, I mean, 50% of what you lived on before is probably quite good.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones. And Robin is with us from Chicago, Illinois. Hi, Robin.
Hi. How are you, Tess?
How are things there in Chi-Town? Are you staying cool?
Not too much. I'm actually in Milwaukee today. I split my work week between both cities.
Oh, wow. What do you do there in Milwaukee, Chicago?
I work for a nonprofit that is a lender and real estate developer to the nonprofit community. So we help nonprofits develop, build, and finance child care centers and health clinics and daycare centers and the like.
Oh, how interesting. Cool. Has that been tough over the last 3-4 years, or has it actually been easier for you because there are properties available?
It's a little bit of both. Yeah. Certainly our loan portfolio has had its rough times as nonprofits get severely cut by government funding, and other times it creates opportunities to build because real estate is so cheap.
Yeah. Well, that must have you in good stead then for understanding the housing market. Do you own a home yourself?
I do, and that leads to my question.
Ah.
I'm walking away from my condo.
Oh, wow. Oh, well, then let's talk to you because this is something that has come up on the show over and over and over again, and people have wanted to hear why someone would voluntarily walk away from their home. So tell us your story.
So bought my first home in 2000 and paid $104,000. 7 years later, chose to sell it. It was a single-family home, and it was the absolute best time in the market. I sold my little $104,000 house in 2 days for $180,000.
Whoa.
Wow.
Actually, I think $185,000 because I made an $80,000 profit. I think that's it. I made an $80,000 profit.
Oh, boy. Those days are long gone.
I know. It was insane. I put a for sale by owner sign in my front yard on Sunday and had an offer within days.
Ugh. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
And so I turned around and took that $80,000, put that down on a new condo.
Mm-hmm.
5 years later in that condo, everything that could go wrong in this condo has gone wrong.
Oh, no.
Structurally, all kinds of structural problems that the developer left behind that I just gave up chasing down the developer because he's long gone. He's not going to do anything about it.
Oh, my gosh.
A condo association that just refuses to function.
Ugh.
And the real kicker was I bought a basement condo, and something is structurally wrong with the building, and my basement condo floods at least once a year.
Yikes. Oh, and it's not something that you're going to be able to sell either.
No, I can't sell, nor can I rent. You know, if I have to disclose this issue.
Wow.
Wow. So you're not walking away because you're underwater. Well, actually, maybe your basement is.
No.
But you're not underwater on your mortgage, but this is really an issue where
underwater and
you can't,
literally, yeah.
You can't live in your home because it's so unpleasant, and you can't sell it because it's so unpleasant. So this is really a different kind of walking away, isn't it, Kathy?
Yeah, you've got such an untenable situation with this condo that I totally see why you're walking away.
Yep. You know? So what did the bank say?
I tried and tried to get the bank's attention. The only way I could get the bank's attention was to stop paying my mortgage.
Yep.
And it took about a year and a half of not making mortgage payments. And over a year and a half, my mortgage was transferred from one servicer to another, both really big banks. And so now, I think it was about June 1st of this year, I finally got a call from my current servicer saying, okay, we'll do. What I've been pursuing is called a deed in lieu of foreclosure.
Kathy, you want to explain quickly what that is?
Yeah, you just hand them the trust deed and they don't, you know, go through the process of foreclosure. But it's essentially the same thing. Your obligations are absolved and they get the house back.
So what happened next?
I took them seriously because there's been a couple of conversations with the bank where they really didn't act on anything, but I took them seriously this time because they said they were going to order an appraisal and do a title search to start this process, and they did both. So the appraisal, I paid $160,000 for this condo, but the appraisal came back at $20,000.
Oh, good Lord.
Whoa.
Wow. As you probably know, I'm going to end up with a tax bill when this is all said and done. That will be the difference between what I owed on my mortgage and this appraisal amount, because that is forgiven debt. But I'm aware that there's a federal program called the Mortgage Foreclosure and Debt Relief Act. As my understanding, it would waive this tax burden.
Yes. It's a temporary program. Goes just until 2012. What will happen is your lender will send you a 1099 that indicates that the forgiven debt is taxable income. You'll file a form called a 982. And it, as far as IRS forms go, it's a pretty easy one to file. And you just check the fact that it was your personal residence. There's this temporary law that allows you to have that tax debt forgiven, and you're done.
Oh, that's so easy, because I've been asking everybody I know professionally, and nobody I've talked to has ever heard of this program.
Kathy, is she still going to take a hit to her credit?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
So this is not going to be painless.
Well, yeah. No. But she's already taken a hit to her credit because she hasn't
stopped
been paying
the mortgage.
Yeah, exactly. So,
right.
So we know
that was part of my decision. I knew I don't really have any interest nor need to buy another house. So that was part of the consideration to say, okay, I'm going to do this.
Yeah. And you know, it's just one of those moments where you say, okay, you know, I've got to start
over.
Got to
do what's best for me.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then I have One other kind of semi-related question. So I have this little nest egg that I've been holding on to of all the mortgage payments I should have been making. The IRS won't ask me to, like, turn that over or anything as part of this then, right?
No. It's not a tax settlement. It's a tax forgiveness program. And like I said, it's temporary. It was specifically to deal with all the people who were losing their homes and were financially pressed.
So they're not going to look at the fact that she has this nice little pile of money and say, well, actually, you need to pay us at least part of that.
Well, they'll have you pay tax on any interest or investment income that you earn, you know, like everybody else.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. And next we have Jay, and he is in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And Jay, I think we're saying welcome back.
Hi, ladies.
So we talked to you earlier this year.
Exactly. And it was shortly after my mother passed away. I was sort of at a critical juncture trying to sort out exactly what to do with some unexpected insurance money.
So let's hear what your question was.
You lose your mother, and it's all very, very new. And when I got a life insurance payout check, it sort of arrived unexpectedly, and I basically turned around and paid off the student loan almost without even thinking about it. So I get the paid in full letter, and I guess my question is, do they pick up on the good things that I do randomly, or do I need to sort of lobby on my behalf to them?
All right, Jay, what has happened since then?
Well, I have a much better credit rating than I did the last time we chatted. Turns out paying off a defaulted student loan was enough to jack my credit score up over 100 points.
Yeah, so,
wow.
Well, congratulations.
Great.
And you had called and were having a tough time, if I remember correctly, because you kind of felt bad that this money that came to you for very sad reasons because your mother had passed away, that perhaps you weren't going to use it the way she would have wanted you to.
I think that she would be delighted to know how empowering that was. I mean, I paid it off so quickly that I didn't even really have a chance to bond with the money.
Wow.
but you know, to be honest, the advice that you gave me about just accessing my credit score and just sort of what a psychological edge that was going to give me moving forward, it was amazing.
Yeah, and the one that you want to make sure that you go to, because it's the government-issued site, is annualcreditreport.com.
Yeah, but
the rest of them are businesses.
And that's for your credit report, not your credit score. Right?
Right. You do have to pay for your credit score.
Yeah. Although you can get your credit score for free at like Credit Karma and a couple of other sites that just allow you to
FICO score. That's not necessarily your FICO, right?
Right. It is not a FICO score, but it's close enough. It's just if you just want to check every once in a while, it's not a bad
thing. Just pay the $15 to get
your
credit.
You can do that too. Yeah.
I think my mom made a lot of financial sacrifices to give my brother and me a better life, like when we were little, there's no doubt. And that's her legacy. It endures. I'm in a better place financially because I mean, I think that's what gave her pleasure, to be honest.
Oh, you're just warming my little motherly heart right here. You know,
that's hope of all parents, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is exactly what you want for your kids. You want to raise them to be happy and healthy and, you know, give them a leg up on life. The fact that your mom could help you after she died, I'm sure, is just something that, you know, if you get to look down from heaven or, you know, whatever you believe, I think that's just got to be a wonderful, wonderful thing.
I have no proof she's not looking down from heaven.
There you go.
Right.
So, well, Jay, what did that mean for your overall finances? I know it helped your credit score. Did it have other impacts as well?
Well, I get pre-approved American Express card offers in the mail now.
You're going to ignore those, right?
I'm ignoring them.
Excellent.
What? Living debt-free as possible and keeping that credit score up really high, I kind of approach it like a video game, you know, sort of like a challenge.
And, I like that.
It's just empowering to have that information.
Absolutely.
Well, that's wonderful. It's really wonderful.
Well,
I'm so glad it's worked out.
Thanks for checking in on me, ladies.
All right. Thanks so much for calling.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Jay.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or you can send us an email. You can do that with the Getting Personal link at our website. It's marketplace.org. Kathy, so great to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Tess.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
Hi, my name is Matthew Kelson, and I'm from Detroit. And I'm in front of the Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles, California. It's a handmade leather wallet that I picked up in Detroit. I used to keep fortunes in here, but I switched wallets. I do have $20 in Canadian. I used to work for a film festival in Windsor, Ontario, and I've had that in my wallet since I worked for the festival. It was an experimental film festival, so they'd have different art films. I did stuff on the U.S. side trying to get people to come across the border. They have Canadian dollars about equivalent now, maybe a little bit more. I've thought of trading it in, but I don't know. Seems like a little bit too much work. So I just keep it in there in case I go to the festival next year, maybe.
From the outside, journalist Carol Ross Joynt had it all, a successful career, a lavish lifestyle. She even won an Emmy for an interview with Charles Manson, and her husband owned a popular bar in Washington, D.C. But after he passed away, she found out he had kept quite a secret from her. Her memoir is entitled Innocent Spouse, and I asked her to start with the day she went to her husband's lawyer after his death, and they mentioned that the IRS had come calling.
I assumed that this would be some formality where they would, have me sign here and sign there and go in peace. Soon after I sat down, the lead lawyer pushed a stack of papers in front of me and said that Howard had been under investigation for criminal federal tax fraud, that the criminal part of it had been dropped, but that they still wanted their money and the case still stood. As his sole heir, you're the defendant.
And the amount at that point was?
They said $3 million.
Man.
I just about fainted out of my seat, but I said to them right then, well, I had nothing to do with this. And they said, well, because you signed the tax return and you inherited his business. And one of the lawyers said to me, well, there is a code in the tax law called innocent spouse. I said, what's that? And she said, well, it's a code that protects a spouse if their spouse has committed tax fraud and they weren't involved.
And the IRS ultimately did grant that to you.
Yes, but those first lawyers said to me when I said, that's me, let's go for it. They said, well, you couldn't possibly get it. And I said, why? They said, look at you.
Look at you. You're dressed nicely. There's no way you couldn't have known about what your husband was doing.
That's what they were saying.
Then how were you able to prove that you indeed did not know anything?
It took a year to build my defense. It's an extensive process because the IRS does not give away innocent spouse. But these are the things that worked in my favor. I'd had my own career throughout our marriage. I'd never worked a day in my life in any restaurant, and certainly not his. And then there were these other things that compounded that innocence. And it only came up after the first draft of my defense was written and I showed it to my sister-in-law. And she found these little lies that he told me. He told me he'd gone to Harvard, but he'd actually gone to the University of Pennsylvania. A silly little lie, but a lie. He told me that the wife before me had been Spanish royalty. Well, she wasn't, as my sister-in-law said, only in her own head. These little examples of him not cluing me in made a very strong defense.
Well, you write that you're still paying the price for your husband's tax fraud. How so?
I am. I mean, my career was derailed. And by getting innocent spouse, it meant anything that was in my name or our names was mine. Anything that was in his name alone, the IRS got. Most of what we had was in his name alone in the sense of stocks and bonds, some property, and his bank account.
Obviously, your story and your situation are unique to you, but as you look back on what happened, Is there any advice you can give in a very general way? You know, I mean, we don't all want to just be suspect of our partners, but...
Well, no. But I'm hearing from so many people, not because they suspect their partner of committing fraud. They usually write to me to say, I am just like you were. You know, I'm in this marriage or I'm in this relationship and I honestly don't know just what our financial picture is. So what I tell people, to quote Ronald Reagan, trust but verify. I was in a very happy marriage and we were very communicative, but I made a huge mistake of not becoming fluent in our personal finances. So have a discussion every now and then with whoever in the family runs the books. Maybe ask that some kind of file folder be set aside that's a roadmap of what should happen in an emergency. And if you're in a will and you're being left a spouse's business, ask a lawyer what your liability is going to be. And always, 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 if the IRS comes knocking, before you answer the door, get a lawyer, even if it's a pro bono lawyer. I benefited very much from pro bono legal help.
Carol Ross Joint's memoir is Innocent Spouse. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tess.
By the way, this week, the IRS changed part of the Innocent Spouse rule. It extends the time that spouses have to file for relief from taxes that they did not know about. We will have more information on that and an excerpt of the book on our blog, The Big Book. It's at marketplace.org. The financial issues surrounding a divorce are messy under just about any circumstance, even when it's amicable. But the housing bust is forcing some couples to sign decrees tying them together for years after the marriage is over because they jointly owned property that is now hard to sell. From station KJZZ in Phoenix, Peter O'Dowd reports on the pitfalls of unloading a house even after you've untied the knot.
One, two, three.
Elle Shelley leafs through a stack of papers. The anchor that's been weighing down her peace of mind since 2007 is buried on the sixth page of her divorce decree.
There it is, right there.
A line of legalese about halfway down.
Husband shall refinance or sell the real property awarded to him herein above at his own expense to remove wife's name from the mortgage.
That hasn't happened.
No.
In case you missed that, Shelley's husband needs to refinance the home in order to get her name off the mortgage. But this is Phoenix. More than half of all homeowners here are underwater on their mortgage, and that makes refinancing almost impossible. What's worse, Shelley signed something called a quitclaim deed. This common divorce agreement stripped her name off the legal documents that made her co-owner of the house. Quitclaims are often required before a bank will refinance in the other spouse's name, but it did not relieve Shelley of responsibility for the mortgage.
No, I mean, I was not bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I knew what I was signing. My thinking on signing the quitclaim deed was that that gave Ryan, or my husband, the permission to take care of refinancing it.
4 years later, still nothing. Shelley makes up to $90,000 a year in the advertising industry, but her lingering mortgage entanglements continue to dog her.
I couldn't rent a house. I couldn't buy a new car. I couldn't do anything without people going, hey, did you know you have a $400,000 mortgage tied to your credit? And I'm like, you're kidding me. Of course I knew.
So this is what it feels like to be married to a mortgage. When Shelley's ex tried getting a loan modification, he stopped making the loan payment. She watched helplessly as her credit score fell. At 28, she's been divorced longer than she was married.
So while on paper, I'm divorced. I mean, am I really? No, absolutely not. I mean, we still have a house together.
She's a typical example of the devastation that it can cause, and she doesn't have anywhere to turn.
Linda Lee Viken heads the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers.
Some people are in a hurry to get a divorce, and so they just agree, this is what I'm going to do. Then they find out 6 months later that it isn't going to happen.
Viken says this reliance on signing away the deed before refinancing causes nightmares for divorcing couples everywhere. The practice is left over from the days when the nation's housing stock was worth a fortune. One spouse gave up ownership and the other quickly sold or refinanced. Everyone cashed out and moved on. Not so in 2011, says Laurel Starks, a real estate agent who specializes in divorce.
It's like bringing a buggy whip to the Model T. It's not going to work.
In reality, there's no easy fix for this. One Phoenix attorney told me he's never once seen a refinance in a divorce case go through since the housing market collapsed. Laurel Starks says the best hope is getting ahead of the problem. Go straight to a short sale.
Just go ahead and rip off the Band-Aid and get off that joint mortgage so that it does not come back and haunt them later.
That's exactly what Kevin Salibi is trying to do.
Y'all done. Good job, Chloe.
Good job,
Salibi girlfriend. And his three children are washing a friend's dog in the backyard of his family home. The ink just dried on his divorce. The agreement gave him full ownership of the house and 2 years to find a way to get his wife of more than a decade off the mortgage. Because that loan was $100,000 underwater, Salibi knew refinancing was useless. He immediately put the house on the market and hoped for a short sale.
I just planned it out. I knew what my options were. I weighed the different options, but out of all the evils, this was definitely the lesser one.
And so far, the plan is working.
Got five offers the first day, accepted the offer. So this is really the final piece of business now that the divorce is final.
But in this market, there's a decent chance the short sale will fall through. Until it's final, Salibi and his ex-wife face the potential for the kind of post-divorce limbo former spouses across the country are struggling through. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace Money.
And now a bulletin for every parent of small children. Deflation has been a lingering concern in our economy, and it is starting to show up under your child's pillow.
We surveyed 1,000 parents nationwide and found that the Tooth Fairy is leaving their children less this year.
That is Jason Alderman, Director of Financial Education for Visa, which conducts this annual survey. The lingering economic downturn has apparently spared no one.
$2.60 is the national average. That's down 40 cents from $3 in 2010.
Wait a minute. Kids are getting more than a quarter for their teeth? When did that happen? Well, we conducted a somewhat unscientific poll of our own to find out what kids think is going on here. Our sample size was 2, so the margin of error is fairly slim. Ella Henn is 9, and the eldest daughter of our technology correspondent, Steve Henn. Her insights?
Tooth Fairy just thinks that the kids are getting too spoiled and they don't need $3 for just a tiny tooth.
Well, her sister Faye is 7.
I think the Tooth Fairy might be running out of money because she always gives kids money and then she might run out of it. Yeah.
No, let's hope not, because Faye has still got some tooth money coming to her. It is, shall we say, a time of unpleasantness in this country. What better to soothe our senses than poetry? Yeah, except this poetry is about the debt ceiling. Oh, we cannot get away from it. Well, let's have some fun then. This all started because of a friend I met on Twitter. His name is Dr. Goose, a.k.a. David Lefkowitz, the CFO of an agricultural trading company. On the side, he writes economic limericks. And so apparently do a lot of you. So David is with us to hear some of your submissions. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So why are limericks, do you think, so well-suited to talking about the economy?
That's a very interesting question. Traditionally, limericks have really been used as a rather risque or even obscene form of poetry. But
well, you could argue that there's some obscenity going on in Washington, couldn't you?
Exactly. It might be a fitting medium to discuss filthy lucre.
Well, you are not an economist, but actually a banker by trade. So
that's true.
How do you pick and choose your topics?
Like everyone else, my reading about things going on in the economy and thinking, do I really understand that? And so being able to write a limerick about it and summarize and express a view on a story in 5 lines that scan and rhyme, it's like a test to myself whether I really have understood the issue. And then, of course, to have some fun with it and share it with other people.
Well, let's get started with some of our listeners' submissions. Last week, we asked folks to send some in that had to do with the debt ceiling. So I'm going to start with the one that is my favorite for what will become obvious reasons. This was sent in by Jan Michael Alejandro. He's a Facebook friend of mine from here in L.A.
This limerick is written for Tess.
regarding the debt ceiling mess. Obama v. Boehner, it couldn't be plainer. It's business as usual, no less.
David, pretty good, I'd say.
Very nice.
Well, you know, we had somewhat of a tough time sifting through all these limericks for ones that were not completely partisan. Our audience, at least, is very, very angry at the moment. But we do have some that are generalized fury against Washington. Here's Steve Weiss from St. Louis, Missouri.
As our Congress bickers some more, political points should be left at the door. I have a sinking feeling if we don't raise the ceiling, we'll surely fall through the floor.
And Phil Graham of Tulsa, Oklahoma.
The Hill won't adjust the debt ceiling, which engenders a real sinking feeling. If they do not act soon, the economy will swoon and the Dow will go crashing and reeling.
David, I think folks got lucky that all these revolved around the word ceiling. Plenty of words to rhyme with that, right?
That's right. You know, finding a word to rhyme is often a challenge. And my rule of writing a good limerick is to start out with the point and the story that you want to tell. And then after that, to try to come up with words that scan and rhyme.
Well, give us one of your debt ceiling limericks.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, just today, I decided to lay odds on the situation in a limerick called Capital Thrill Seeker. A fellow who loved a good thrill made a bet on the debt ceiling bill, going 7-3 on a yes from the GOP caucus on Capitol Hill.
Oh, that was close. You couldn't end on GOP caucus, right? That'd be a different line.
We had to split the rhyme and rhyme on the G and get the OP onto the last line.
Well, I know folks posted on your blog as well. Got a favorite from there.
Joey Polanski wrote, "The experts have certainly said it, that default would ruin our credit. But is the solution in our Constitution? What's more, has the government read it?"
Oh, snap.
Yeah.
And finally, we have Madeline Kane of Bayside, New York, and she posted this on our Facebook page.
As the Pauls in D.C. vent their spleen over actions that should be routine, our land's on the brink of a crisis, some think, was created on purpose. Obscene.
Indeed. Indeed.
Yes.
David Lefkowitz, a.k.a. Dr. Goose, this has been so much fun. Folks, you can find his limericks on his blog, limerickseconn.com, and we'll have a link on our website. You can follow him, as I said, on Twitter at limerickseconn and do it just to see the avatar, if for no other reason. And before we go, I'm told that you wrote a limerick just for us.
Well, that's right. Let me just advise the audience, for financially sound information, tune your local public radio station, where the Marketplace crew and Tess Vigeland, too, will firm your financial foundation.
Love it. David, thanks so much. It's been fun.
Tess, thank you so much for having me.
And we put up a special page on our website this weekend where you can see all, well, almost all of the limericks you sent about the debt ceiling debacle. It's marketplace.org. And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and listener Lynn Roundtree. He's a historian and a longtime owner of a bookstore there. He is also a tweeter, and he managed to send us a limerick in a single tweet. To wit, while D.C. debates the debt ceiling, endlessly wheeling and dealing, the dollar will drop and markets will top, I'm left with a sinking feeling. Well done in 140 characters. Your tweet earns you a pig. See, birds and pigs can get along. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, say your favorite Uncle Bob hits you up for a loan. Telling him no can be tough, but going ahead and lending to him could cost you a whole lot more.
It's always dangerous to loan money to relatives. Family's too valuable to risk on a disagreement on a loan.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Special thanks this week to Patty Hirsch for not making me talk about body parts. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.